Hi everyone, and welcome to this week Quantum Gravity Seminar. Today our speaker is Francesco Di Filippo from Yukawa Institute for Theoretical Physics in Kyoto, and he will talk about on the assumptions leading to the information loss paradox. As usual, if you want to ask a question, just raise your hand on Zoom, or you can also use the Google form to ask anonymous questions. And with this, Francesco, you can start whenever you want.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Alessia, for the introduction and for the invitation. I'm very happy to be able to give a seminar on this this work here that I've done in collaboration with Luca Boninfante and Shinji Mukoyama. And as you will see, this is a work, it's quite conceptual, it's completely non-technical. So if you want to stop me at any moment, but, please feel free to do that. It's always possible, but when it's conceptual rather than technical, it's even more because it's nice to turn it to discussion, if possible. And so I will discuss the information loss paradox. And let me start with a brief introduction. And we live now in very exciting times for what concerns the study of black hole physics, because we can test with increasing higher precision the space-times on the exterior of black holes. But on the other hand, we know that it's impossible to test directly the interior, and we actually still lack a consistent interior to describe the interior. And if we take the point of view of the cosmic censorship conjecture, in particular the weak cosmic censorship conjecture, then maybe there is no problem from outside observer from the classical point of view, because the singularities and the places in which the theory will break down are shielded behind an event horizon. But if you take into account the semi-classical picture, things will change immediately. And at the semi-classical level, as you know, the black hole evaporates. And this eventually will lead to the information loss paradox. And I would like to start discussing why, so for giving a precise formulation of the problem, because I feel that sometimes the assumption behind this formulation are a bit overlooked. So I think it's instructive to start giving a detailed formulation. And I believe that there are at least two non-equivalent ways to formulate the problem. The first one, we can call case A the unitarity problem, is the contradiction between this set of assumptions. So the first assumption is simply a statement that quantum states evolve in a unitary way. And so in particular, if you start with a pure state, you will evolve into a pure state. The second assumption instead is the validity of semi-classical general relativity as a good low energy effective description to describe the black hole physics during the entire evaporation process. And finally, we assume that the black hole evaporates completely and leave a regular space-time. And of course, if you put together these three assumptions, it's immediate that we will end up into a contradiction, because whatever states you use to form the black hole, then you're left with nothing, because you're left with pure thermal radiation. And of course, this will violate the unitary evolution of quantum mechanics. However, if we look now at there's already a question. Yeah,
yes, Laurent.
Yeah, I have a question about this hypothesis. So one hypothesis that in fact is key to lead to this paradox that you're not phrasing, and in fact, which is my hypothesis, which is wrong, is the hypothesis that the Hilbert space of gravitational theory admits a factorization. That is, you can act on one state here without affecting the other. So that's an hypothesis which is even not true at the semi-classical level.
Yeah, I agree. So, this formulation of the problem, I think you will agree, so you don't need this hypothesis, right? Because if you put a pure state into sigma 1 and you assume this, then in sigma 3, you will have a mixed state, right? But I agree that there are problems with this solution.
Well, if you believe that diagram, but yeah. Okay,
I guess that's exactly what I was going there. So I was just building up slowly to.
But the information problem was already formulated at the level of sigma 2. So you know,
yes,
you
yes,
the paper.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is that the original formulation of problem where you know Hawking said that you cannot raise on sigma 2 information inside the horizon is simply not true, right?
Because yeah, I'm going there in two slides, I think.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
There is also another question by Nihayas.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on that. I think the assumption of effective field theory, I mean, that's what the factorization is. So because effective field theories do allow factorization, but as you mentioned, gravity doesn't. So I think that's the one that would be violated. The factorization, if you assume at A2, you assume factorization. And I think, I mean, gravity obviously doesn't.
Okay. Well, like maybe it's a problem of, maybe we can go. It's a problem of language. It's massive effectivity theory. I mean, factorization, massless effectivity theory do not admit factorization. So if you do proper mm-hmm. effectivity theory, you don't make the wrong assumption.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's I guess that's a matter of definition. Okay, thanks.
Okay. But as what what I wanted to say is that this formulation is probably not particularly worrisome for the following reason, and I put again the Peierls diagram here. The point is that sometimes it's not appreciated is that this Peierls diagram, it has a Cauchy horizon here, and the state in this region here is in the causal feature of the singularity. So you cannot really trust this description. You can go from sigma 1 to sigma 2, but you cannot go from sigma 2 to sigma 3 at this stage. Because the initial value problem will, the semi-classical initial value problem is not defined in this region. And also, in principle, there is no reason why the space time, the remaining space time should be regular. You could be end up with a singular space time, this described here in this diagram. And all in all, I would say that what we can describe is this diagram here, the maximum Cauchy, the only this part of the space time we can describe. So up until the Cauchy horizon, and of course here, if you start from a pure state on sigma one, you will have a pure state on sigma two, but you don't necessarily need a pure state on sigma three, simply because the space time is not geodesically complete. So even if evolution operator is unitary, you do not need to evolve a pure state into a pure state. So all I wanted to say is that although this formulation is very simple, it's not particularly worrisome that you end up with a contradiction. But as it was anticipated, we can have a different formulation that we can call the entropy problem, in which the problem arises much before. And in this case, the problem is an incompatibility between these three different assumptions, different set of assumptions. So the first one is unchanged, simply pure state evolving a unitary wave. The second assumption instead is only valid until you are far from the Planckian regime. So you assume semi-classical general relativity, but only far away from the Planckian regime. On the other hand, you need to assume something more. And in particular, you need to assume what is recently starting to be called the central dogma, which is that as seen from outside, a black hole behaves like a quantum system, and the number of degrees of freedom is given by the area, in the area of the apparent horizon. And the reason why this leads to a problem, I think, is familiar to everyone. This is the standard page argument. If you plot as a function of some time, of course, the quantitative shape of this picture will depend on which time function you're picking, but the qualitative aspects will not. So just pick some time, and you plot the area of the evaporating black hole. and you plot the radiation, the entropy of the radiation, the evaporating black hole, at some point at the page time, you will get a crossover, and the number of degrees of freedom inside, the number of degrees of freedom of the black hole are not going to be enough to be entangled with the radiation, and you will have a problem when the black hole is still macroscopic and very far from the Planck regime. However, this assumption B3 is of course crucial. And if we drop it, we will not end up in any problem. We will only be able to describe a portion of the space-time before giving a quantum gravity completion of the theory. But in this portion of the space-time, there is no problem. Therefore, it's important to ask why do we assume the central dogma? What are the reasons behind it? And to quantify if it is an assumption, if this is a theorem. And so I think that the main reason behind the central dogma is the fact that the course of Bayes' standard thermodynamic laws with the thermodynamic entropy given by the Beckett cycling formula, which is simply the entropy, the thermodynamical entropy of the black hole is just the area divided by 4g. Then for a generic system, gravitational or gravitational, we know that the thermodynamical entropy is always an upper bound for the von Neumann entropy. This is true for any system. And so this suggests that the apparent horizon area has an intrinsic statistical nature, and it will bound the number of internal states by this quantity here, E to the S black hole, Beckett-Snellking. Furthermore, there are other reasons, one of which is the Beckett-Snell bound, which is a bound for the maximum amount of entropy that you can put inside the region of a given radius. And if you apply this to the Schwarzschild geometry, you get exactly that the entropy is bounded by the Beckett-Snellking value. Or the holographic principle is giving you that, it's telling you that the number of degrees of freedom is proportional to an area. At this stage, you cannot say it's the apparent horizon area or something else, but it's an area. And finally, the fact that it is difficult to obtain a different limit for the von Neumann entropy. So if we don't assume that the entropy is bounded by the area, it might probably be unbounded. And this is usually advocated that this will lead to some problem due to the fact that we have a fixed side object with an unbounded entropy, and you will produce them in scattering experiments, and you will not be consistent with what you observe. But these are the standard arguments, I would say. Probably if someone wants to add something, we can do them in a discussion session. But now I want to shift focus and ask, is there a reason not to believe in the central dogma, or are these arguments completely stringent? And to this end, let me discuss this very idealized thought experiment. It's just a toy model, but it captures some important physics. And for the sake of the argument, for the moment, we assume the assumption we call B2. So semiclassical general relativity is a good, valid, low energy effective field theory to describe black holes far from the Planck regime. So at the horizon scale, and even in the interior, when you're far away from the Planck regime, which is what we will expect in given general relativity and equivalence principle, nothing special happening at the horizon. And if you assume this, then we can consider this this space-time in which we have an external observer. And this external observer can be a classical observer. It can be free-falling if it is orbiting around the black hole, very far away from the black hole. And they can prepare a pure state. And this pure state, they can decide to throw half of the state towards K+ and half of the state toward the black hole. This rate of absorption of the black hole, so how much energy is absorbing for a unit of time, is completely arbitrary because it's the classical observer, faraway observer, which is designing it. And in particular, we can decide to tune it exactly equal to the outgoing Hawking flux. So this black hole is a macroscopic black hole, so the mass is much larger than black mass. You are well within the adiabatic approximation, which means that you can control how much this external energy is going to change the Hawking emission, which is going to be negligible. I'm not talking about thermality of the external emission, just saying there is an ongoing flux. So everything is under control here. Of course, you cannot throw a continuous flux of energy because you will need a massless particle. You will need to have a very large wavelength, but you can throw small pulses of energy, such as the rate is equal to the ongoing Hawking flux rate. And as long as these pulses have an energy much, much smaller of the black hole mass, which is guaranteed from the fact that you want the flux to be equal to the outgoing Hawking flux, everything is under control, given this assumption B2. And the mass of the black hole in particular is constant. I mean, there are some tiny fluctuations, but it's overall constant. And so, why we are doing this? We are doing this because now an observer on Scrape Plus, far from the black hole, is going to collect half of the state. And it can measure the entropy of this half of the state that they are collecting. And there is nothing going on particular here for black hole physics, simply because of the assumption B2. And so you can plot as a function of some time t, you can plot two quantities, actually three. So you can plot the area, which is basically constant. You can plot the entropy of the outgoing Hawking radiation, which maybe we do not know how it's going to be. It can be the one predicted by Hawking computation, which is a monotonic increasing function, or you could follow the Page curve, so it could saturate at the area, at the value of the area of the black hole. But regardless of what the outgoing Hawking radiation is doing, the entropy of the matter degrees of freedom that the classical observer is throwing in, they are completely under control. And this is a monotonic increasing function. And it depends on how the observer is preparing the state. But at some point, of course, it's going to take a very, very long time, but at some point, it will exceed the value of the area. And so what this toy model is telling us is that completely independently of the behavior of the radiation, the entropy of the radiation, the central dogma has to be violated if this assumption B2, semi-classical general relativity, holds at the horizon scale. So in this sense, this is a refinement of the problem because we completely eliminated this, what the first assumption, right? We are left only with two of them. And there was no unitarity assumption in this discussion, just semi-classical general relativity and the central dogma. So I see that there is a question, so maybe now is a good moment.
Yeah, I think it's maybe what you call B2. I think you made an assumption in your calculation, which in fact violated by the proper treatment of semi-classical GR, right? So you make the assumption that, the observer, which is outside the black hole, can measure the radiation without affecting the internal states. And that assumption is only valid if you forget that there's an Hamiltonian constraint, which is an elliptical constraint that correlates the degrees of freedom inside and outside. So if by semi-classical GR you mean classical GR forgetting the presence of Hamiltonian constraints, then yes. But you know, if you take semi-classical GR and take into account the fact that the states are not split, maybe you can call it B2 prime, then you will have, I mean, anyway, this argument, these assumptions you're making is exactly the thing which everybody's making, the split property of the Hilbert space, which is not true.
But I think it's different. So the reason why we introduce this matter flux is because it's a different, so we could have done this taking the semi-classical approximation, saying, okay, you have an effective stress energy tensor, you have a flux, you have an ingoing and outgoing flux of Hawking radiation, and we could have done exactly the same with the Hawking radiation, right? But then I agree that that there are many subtleties, but this is a state which is prepared far away from the black hole, and I am only assuming the equivalence principle. I'm not sure.
No, that part is fine. No, you're assuming. You say something later. You're assuming something, which is you're assuming that you know. You think that an observable which act on sigma outside of the black hole commute with an observable which act inside. You have to assume that, otherwise you. But that property is simply not true in a constrained system. That is, if you take a gravitational observable that commutes with the gravitational, it does not commute with an observable inside. So this, what you call semi-classical GR, is doesn't satisfy the principle of your theory, which is that you have to respect the Hamiltonian constraints. So if you let go of the Hamiltonian constraints and you assume that in inside states and outside states are independent, yes, but that's a violation of what we know GR, even classical GR, is.
Yeah, but...
And at the quantum level, you can show that you can, let's say, you can take things like the Bondi mass or some charge operator, which are defined purely outside, and they correlate to excitation inside the black hole. And you can, you know, extract some information out of that. So that assumption of the split property, that there is no Hamiltonian constraint, is the source of the problem.
Yeah, but what which part? So what is in this graph? You will not you will disagree with. So this is if you want, this is almost classical state, right? That I'm trying half in and half out.
No, but that doesn't respect again. Statement does not respect the classical. So whatever outside radiation there is completely correlated because of what I say, every physical operator is highly non-local on any slice. So if you let go of that, then sure. If you assume that Hilbert space factorized, that space-like operators commute, then yeah, you're fine. But space-like operator, like physical operator on space-like slice in gravity do not commute. That's, anyway. That has to be
anyhow. So I think this is a pretty long discussion. And I see also that there are three more questions. So Carlo, Barbara, and Charlie, who wrote on the chat. So if you have quick questions or comments, go ahead. If there is a long discussion, it's better to postpone it to the end of the talk.
It's a short comment. It's a short comment. I want to say that I understand that Francesco is right in spite of what Laurent says. What Laurent says might be true, but it doesn't change the fact that what Francesco is saying is correct. Because in the theory that Francesco is considering is classical GR with a given metric that we know, and the specific back reaction computed from the expectation value of the field that we know, that can be computed explicitly, apart from the granularity of the thing coming inside, perhaps. What Francesco said just follows in that theory. It's just standard quantum field theory on a classical geometry that has a macroscopic back reaction. There's nothing mysterious in that. Laurent might be right that there are other phenomena that comes in and are relevant, but these are not in the approximation that Francesco is considering.
Yeah, so you explained much better what I wanted to say when I say that it's exactly why we are not taking the expectation value of the quantum stress energy tensor, the flux of going and ingoing quanta, because in that case there will be many objections. But here you have a classical background, and we are calculating things on top of that. Yes, thank you. You explained it much better than exactly what I wanted to say, but you explained it better. And do you want the other questions? I don't see any other.
So there is raised and by Barbara. So Barbara, just go ahead if it is a short question. Otherwise, it's better to postpone.
Sure, sure. I have one objection to what's written on the slide. You said that you can make the ingoing energy flux equal to the outgoing Hawking flux, and therefore you can make the mass of the black hole constant.
Yes. On average.
I think this is what Laurent was trying to say. This is assuming that there's an observer outside that's measuring the Hawking flux, but then, you know, he's measuring what's going on with the black hole, and he is feeding back the energy flux immediately to keep the black hole mass constant. There's an analogy of this in the Unruh effect, where the Unruh-Davitt detector releases, a photon, whatever, and then the agent that's accelerating it would, in principle, have to make up for the recoil of the detector to keep the detector on a constant accelerated trajectory. You see my point here. So because everything is quantum, you really cannot make the mass of the black hole constant. You can make it maybe constant on average, but because... Yeah, okay. That's my only objection. I think that's similar to what we're saying.
So this is exactly my point. I know it's impossible. I don't need the mass to be exactly constant. I only need to be a constant on average. And I only need the fluctuation to be negligible with respect to the mass of the black hole. So as long as kappa dot over kappa squared kappa the extrinsic curvature is much smaller than one, this, the adiabatic approximation holds and everything is good, is fine. And kappa, you can, this is purely classical quantity to evaluate. And as long as you have the call, which is much larger than the Planck mass, you can do that on average. I agree, there are tiny fluctuations, but these are under control.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you for the question.
Okay, so let's just continue with your presentation and postpone all questions to the end of the talk.
Okay. So the next of the presentation is simply trying to answer to this question, what went wrong? Because when we were giving the justification to the central dogma, they were all framed within general relativity. And it seems that here I only assume general relativity and I can, so I found this incompatibility between the two. And The most important one, I think, is the biggest Hawking entropy that I was describing before. In order to understand what can go wrong, let's for a second forget about black holes and gravity. Let's just think about a standard system. And I will make this standard system composed of two subsystems, A and B. And this is the inequality I was writing before that is always true. However, what I can do is I can put these two systems very far apart, so that they are no longer in causal contact with each other. And now I can focus on system A and I can study the thermodynamics of system A. And when I do that, I don't need to consider the system B because it's not in causal contact with it. And I can study the thermodynamic just with this, the degrees of freedom in this part of the system. And of course, this is a triviality, the thermodynamical entry of the system A is not a bound for the von Neumann entropy of the two systems, of the union of the two systems. The point is that for the thermodynamical arguments, I can consider only system A, but if there is some entanglement with the third system, let's say C, and the two A and B, I cannot split them anymore. And how does this, what did I say to do with what we were saying? So simply, we are just arrived to this statement here, that the von Neumann entropy of the gravitational degrees of freedom and the matter degrees of freedom that I was throwing inside the black hole, this became greater than the area at some point. And given the assumption that I was giving, and this was inequality, a strict inequality, actually not the equal sign. But this is not a paradox. It simply means that given the assumptions, the area cannot describe the thermodynamical entropy of the full black hole system, given so gravity plus matter. So given the assumption, it means that the area only describes the thermodynamical entropy of the gravitational degrees of freedom that describe the horizon physics. Whereas whatever are the matter degrees of freedom, they are the analogs of system B. So they are entangled with what is outside. We cannot discard them when we compute the fundamental entropy, but we can forget them when we study thermodynamics. Of course, this is not obvious that this is going to be the case, but what I'm saying is that if you assume this assumption B2, then this has to happen because otherwise you will have a contradiction. And okay, there is this possibility was also discussed in this paper that in the beginning we missed. But yeah, it basically was the same what I'm saying. And actually, this comment here is just because when I start thinking about this problem, what there was something that was puzzling me is that when you, if you have a star, you have the entropy, the thermodynamic entropy is a volume law, follow a volume law. It does not follow an area law. Instead, if you have a black hole, you have an area law. So I was wondering what happened during the gravitational collapse. How do you go from a volume to an area law? And actually, if you believe in this interpretation, if you accept this interpretation for a moment, this would be for free because it simply means that the matter degrees of freedom will follow a volume law, will keep following a volume law, but they will decouple from the outside observer, so you can discard them, and instead this gravitational degrees of freedom will follow an area law, and so this will be completely free. And what are these gravity degrees of freedom? Well, the answer is that I don't know because it depends on the theory of quantum gravity, it depends on the model that you're using. And there are several works that are looking for a microscopic interpretation of the black hole entropy in loop quantum gravity, in string theory, also in some model of corpuscular gravity, for instance. I will not go into them because, first of all, I'm not an expert, but because it's not particularly relevant for what I want to say here. What I want to say here is that it's possible that these degrees of freedom, they only describe the gravitational degrees of freedom. So I'm not claiming that there is some contradiction between gravity, general relativity, and the fact that in loop quantum gravity, in string theory, you get an area law. Actually, the opposite. This can give you an interpretation of these degrees of freedom. And if you violate the central dogma, it simply means that the matter degrees of freedom should be taken into account separately. Otherwise, you can take an opposite point of view and say that you stick with the central dogma. So the degrees of freedom given by the area is going to give you the whole description. And simply this means that you have to violate the assumption that I was given here before B2. Now, very quickly, I want to go to the other reason to believe in the central dogma, just to mention them quickly. So the Bekesen bound that I was mentioning before, it's important to note that the Bekesen bound is proved rigorously only in the context of quantum field theory in flat space-time. You cannot prove it generically. So what you can have in generic space-time is what's called the Boost covariant entropy bound. You can apply it, and it actually reduces to the Bekesen bound for a Schwarzschild black hole, but it assumes dominant energy conditions that are violated in our example because they're violated by the flux walking radiation. And it actually makes sense, right? Because if you want to obtain a bound for the entropy in a given size, you cannot use, I mean, if you have something which has a negative energy but positive entropy, you will violate this bound, right? This is simply a physical interpretation that is behind why you need the dominant energy condition to prove this statement. And you can apply some quantum version of the Boost bound, but this does not imply the central dogma. So as in this scenario, which you have an evaporating black hole, there is no, strictly speaking, a bound that you can apply. And instead, the last concern was about the fact that if you have an abundant Neumann entropy, you can produce this object in scattering processes. But okay, here I don't have a precise reply, but I wonder if we can really treat black holes as particles in quantum field theory space-time. Because what does it mean that the size is small? Like, I agree the area is small, but the volume is huge. And these are not elementary systems. You have a lot of matter inside, and this is only because of the matter that you can violate the bound. Anyway, this will not actually violate our construction, because it simply means, because we arrive only just our contradiction between two assumptions. And if you are telling me that if you violate the central dogma, then you are not with observation, this simply would be great, because it would mean that you have some observation to decide which of the two assumptions violate. But on top of that, I need to be honest, and I'm not sure I agree with this argument. So maybe someone can convince me about this argument. This is just what I want to say. So what I want to say is that it would be great if this argument was correct, because we will get some experimental some experimental observables. But I'm not sure if this argument can be applied. And okay, maybe I can skip this, because. We are a bit late. Just to say, so this is basically the result. It's just a refined contradiction. Before I was listing the assumption B2. Actually, if you think about it, this B2 was, you could actually split it into parts. The first part is that the black hole, if the mass is much larger than the Planck mass, will emit thermal radiation according to the semi-classical general relativity. And the second part is that in falling matter, far from the Planck regime, obey the laws of general relativity, and in particular the equivalence principle. And why I'm doing this distinction? Because actually the entropy problem you can formulate with the first one, the assumption B2A. Sorry if there are too many letters, if it's confusing, but I think it's being schematic helps clearness. And instead, the contradiction is between B2B and the central dogma, just to be precise. Okay. So I want to briefly comment on some link with some. Maybe this is a good point for question. I see there is Niyesh raised the hand.
Yes. Could you go back to the previous slide?
This one?
So your claiming is that the only contradiction that you see is between B2B and central dogma. So you say basically you cannot have basically entropy being area over 4G, total entropy, and in falling matter just falling in without.
So what I want to say here is that I think everyone will agree that if you want the central dogma, you need to have some kind of violation of general relativity at the Rayson scale. But what I want to say is that this violation is kind of strong. It's not enough to violate B2A, meaning it's not enough to change for instance, the thermality property of the Hawking flux. You need something stronger. So as long as you have some non-zero outgoing flux, then you need to change B2B. So you need to change the equivalence principle.
Go ahead, finish your sentence.
Yeah. So of course, if you have exactly zero going flux, then you have no problem. But as soon as you have a non-zero going flux, the contradiction is this with this second part. So it is stronger. It's not, you cannot just change the property of the Hawking flux.
Wanted to then mention that's exactly the argument that you for echoes basically. So you're saying that in falling matter should have echoes because they should they cannot just fall in, right?
Yeah, probably.
If central dogma is true, but yeah, I think that's.
Yeah, I don't know how observable that would be, because this would be very, very,
It must be a big effect. It cannot be a small effect. So that's what you're saying.
Well, but because if I just throw matter inside, the area will increase. If you throw very, very little matter, which is bounded, which is balanced by the Hawking radiation, then the area will not increase and you will violate the central dogma. But I mean, to be observable, it cannot just be, you will have an outgoing flux, which is the energy of the Hawking radiation, right? It's not much. I don't think it's going to be, I mean, it's not the echoes that we are looking for, right? In gravitational, I don't think at least.
We could discuss that later, I think.
Yeah, thank you. So maybe, given that it would be nice to leave as much time as possible for discussion, I want just to discuss the firewall proposal. So you probably noticed that this logic is very similar to the logic of the firewall that one was following. But so the incompatibility of the firewall. Let me go back to our assumptions. So in the paper of the firewall, these are the assumptions that are made. And actually, this B3 assumption is kind of in a different level. So they found some incompatibility between these two, because this is assumed from the beginning to all true. Whereas, so in this sense, this will be this B1 and B2A and B2B and B3. So it's an incompatibility between these four assumptions. But what we actually did was to find an incompatibility between just the last two of them. And so in this sense, it's compatible, but it's even more general. And of course, it's in our toy model study. But if we want this law to be universal law of nature, then it has to be they need to be true, even if you don't have exactly a realistic configuration. But yeah, as long as it's a possible configuration, these laws should be true. And so this is it basically. So this is how the information loss paradox is usually stated. These four assumptions that I went through several times. Quantum mechanics tell you that pure state evolve into pure state, so unitary evolution. Then you evoke irradiation, and according to semi-classical general relativity, far from the Planck regime. Then you have the equivalence principle, basically telling you in falling matter, obey the law of general relativity, nothing special happened at the trapping horizon. And then you have the central dogma. The number of degrees of freedom from outside observer is bounded by the area. What our toy model is telling us that actually you have a contradiction between these last two. And the amazing thing is that there is no trace of information in these two, right? There is no, in this sense, the information loss paradox has nothing to do with the loss of information. And you can formulate the information loss paradox in a different way. You can eliminate this B2B and you can do this, these three assumptions. But then this is incompatible with the equivalence principle generativity. So definitely we should not say that the information loss paradox is an incompatibility between GR and quantum mechanics, but at most the information loss paradox is incompatible with general relativity, right? And with this, okay, this is what I just said. And with this, what I mean is that when I say that the information loss paradox has nothing to do with the loss of information, I'm not saying that the information is not lost. I'm saying, I don't know, the information might be lost, might not be lost. So depending on whether or not you form an event horizon, but within the realm of semi-classical general relativity, you cannot say that, you simply cannot say that. You cannot argue in neither direction. And then the final question is, which one should we keep, general relativity or the central dogma? And I don't know. I mean, I have some, I mean, of course, probably my personal bias was clear during the talk, but my point is that it's not, I don't want to advocate one or the other possibility. I just want to say either are fine, but you simply cannot take both. And everyone should be free to choose which one seems more reasonable, but you simply cannot take both. This is the takeover message. And yeah, let's stop here so that we should have this time for questions. That's planned.
Thanks, Francesco, for this very nice and interesting talk.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with the discussion session. So I would like to start with questions from students. And I think there was at some point a question by Charlie who wrote in the chat. Charlie, so do you want now to express your conclusion?
Sure. So when you're talking about why not the central dogma, you showed these graphs of all the various entropies. Could you maybe go back to that slide?
Sorry, just a sec. Oh, what happened? So these ones?
Right. So I guess my confusion is that my understanding is that the entropy that we should be thinking about is the minimum of all these curves. And so I don't see what the issue is, because then it seems to me, at least on the right hand side, it seems like that the central dogma is correct then, that the entropy is just the area.
Why the minimum? Why should we take the minimum? Like, the entropy should be the sum, right? The
entropy should be the sum. I guess, you know, normally in thermodynamics, you take the you could have a sort of multi-valued distribute, like a multi-valued function for your potential, but you always take the minimum, and that leads to things like phase transitions and stuff. But again, I might just be confusing myself.
No, here is slightly different, the logic. So what I'm saying here is that at Sky Plus, an observer will measure several things. It will measure the matter that this observer is throwing out, so the half of this state, and they will observe the Hawking flux. And so they will both have some entropy. And so the total number of degrees of freedom is the union, right? It's the sum. It's not the minimum of the two. So this is why I was saying you can, for the argument, we don't really need to care about what this radiation is doing, because the total number of degrees of freedom is, of course, greater than the number of the degrees of freedom of one part of the system.
Right? Sorry, I guess I'm confused then, because I thought the blue line was... So the blue line is for matter degrees of freedom outside the black hole.
So this blue line is the observer.
Sorry, the blue line on the other graph. There's more than
this one. Yes.
Yeah. Sorry. So that's for entropy of matter outside the black hole.
Yeah. So this basically this red arrows that intersect this arrows that describe sigma.
And I guess I'm still confused, just because. I guess then what is the yellow curve? What entropy is the yellow curve supposed to measure? Of the Hawking radiation?
Yes, it's the Hawking radiation. And we don't know exactly what this is going to be, like, because there are several subtleties how to do this computation. The Hawking computation is going to give you that. And if you want the page curve, you will have something like this, because the area is constant, so it does not need to go to zero. It has to be just bounded. But
if you turned off this sort of ingoing flux, then shouldn't the second half of the page curve kind of come back?
Sorry?
So you're throwing in the equal amount of Hawking radiation, basically.
Yes.
So if you stop doing that, you should get the second half of the page curve again, right? Because it's going to...
If you stop doing that, you will not get any contradiction. This is true. But what I say, this... If you want this law, like this, if you want the entropy to be bounded by the central dogma, you want this to be something universal, right? So it's not something that will only hold in some situation. So you just need to find some contradiction. So if you don't throw matter, you don't have any apparent contradiction. It's not clear that you have a contradiction, but you are free to throw matter if you want. You can choose which matter to throw.
I'm a student, so I'm just trying to make sure I'm not just confusing myself. But so the problem is that the central dogma would say the blue plus the yellow line is equal to the area, and the point
is
that
bounded by the area. That's what we would say. The total one is bounded by the area.
I thought the central dogma was saying degrees of freedom of the black hole plus matter inside the black hole, like just everything inside the horizon.
Yeah, then you will not have any issue with the information loss paradox, right? So everything is outside your horizon is bounded by the area. This is what you mean? Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Not just the yellow, everything is bounded by the area. But everything, so the degrees of freedom inside the black hole, you know, with this assumption here, they have to be at least enough to be entangled with the blue line, at least. This is the very minimum that you need, that they are inside the black hole. So this is why you are violating the central dogma.
Are there more questions, especially from students? Okay, so while the others think about questions, I would also have a couple of questions. I see now that there is Carlos, but let me ask first. So it is probably a basic question, but so when you say that we have to choose between general relativity and the central dogma, so when you refer to general relativity, what are you precisely talking about? So are you referring only to equivalence principle or yeah. also the dynamic, specific dynamics of general relativity? So for instance, what would happen if you have something like F of R gravity?
No, here you're referring to, look, it's actually even weaker than the equivalence principle. It's the fact that a free-falling observer, mm-hmm. So a free-falling state is not going to be destroyed when it crosses the trapping horizon, which is obviously going to be true if you have an equivalence principle of general relativity, because mm-hmm. you can calculate the interaction that is going to have to with the Hawking quanta, and it's going to interact only with the low energy photons, and so everything is under control. You might have something f of r, and still you will get the contradiction. But mm-hmm. at least if you have the equivalence principle, for sure you have a contradiction.
Okay, thanks, Carlo.
Yeah, thank you. I want to make two comments. Some general comments. It's also. Know how you react to the second. So first of all, I do think that what Francesco is saying is exactly right. And I think he's really putting the finger on the source of the huge confusion about the black hole information paradox. And the two points I want to make. First, the clearest point, which is I think continuously escaping in this discussion, is that the von Neumann entropy can be much higher than the thermodynamical entropy. The example that he made, which is taking two systems and putting them at large space-like separation. I find it brilliant because it just shows that this can happen in just a completely no gravity, no space-time curve, nothing dynamical about space-time in a system completely under control. But this is also exactly what is going on, because then there is a space-time separation between the internal and the external of a black hole on a Cauchy's light like sigma 2 he's considering. So I think that the point that Francesco Simplicis is saying very very strongly, in fact, which is the central dogma just doesn't follow from anything we know about current physics. It's a solution of the black hole information paradox. Now, the second comment I want to make, Francesco, can you put the slide where you had the three different quantum gravity ways of viewing, of deriving the yeah. No, there was one explicit in, yeah, this one is good enough. So I want to comment about the first two in relation to the to this story. The first one is that in loop quantum gravity, the number of state of a black hole it's given by the area, but this has nothing to do with what happened inside the black hole. This is a story about the horizon. It's completely a story about the horizon. So if you take loop quantum gravity seriously, you have to assume that there's something else going the other side of the horizon, because that's what the theory is talking about. There are other degrees of freedom, and you can be entangled with that. So loop quantum gravity, as it is formulated, allows phenomena entropy to be larger than the black hole entropy. Coming back in a moment. Now let me go to string theory and to the sort of ADF-CFD story. Now, at first, it seems that the argument for the central argument is stronger, right? Because in the Stroming of Alpha calculation, everything that follows later from that, you do map the number of degrees of freedom of the black hole to the what you see at the at infinity. You count there, and this is that you don't have other degrees of freedom. So where are the other degrees of freedom? Under the hypothesis of string theory. Now, I don't think the hypothesis of string theory in that case should be wrong, or the FCFD be wrong, but there's something else subtly going on. Namely, these are the number of degrees of freedom that you can access, assuming that the horizon is an event horizon. Namely, assuming that you're essentially in a stationary, if not static, situation. So what people have in mind is a definition of a black hole as a black hole being an event horizon. But black hole being an event horizon is an assumption about quantum gravity, namely what happened at the end of evaporation, right? Because if at the end of the evaporation, at the end of the evaporation outside the horizon, curvature is Planckian. So you're deep in the quantum gravity regime outside the horizon. So you don't know, unless you have a full quantum gravity theory dynamical of what happens at the end of evaporation, you don't know what happened to the internal degrees of freedom and how they come out. So in other words, I think the string theory calculation is compatible with existence of degrees of freedom inside, which can be, of course, accessed from infinity, right? Which is the, let me call the weak holographic hypothesis, but not at the time before somehow the light moving along the horizon gets infinity. If it is not an event horizon, there's a part of Scribe Plus which is after that. And in fact, there are calculations in lower dimensional models of string theory where actually, of ADF-CFD where actually this happens. So it seems to me that the source of the confusion is double. One is the sort of the ingrained belief that the thermodynamic entropy bounds the phenomenon entropy, which is just false, it's a fact. I mean, just elementary physics. But there's a second one, which is that the quantum gravity calculations that go that says that the number of degrees of freedom is it's bounded by the area, they're all under the assumption that the event, the horizon is an event horizon. Namely, they all hold only until before the evaporation. And then, of course, it's like it's exactly like your example in which you move something very far away. If you move something very far, the second box AD, the second box very very far away, you lose access to the information there. So you have an information paradox. But in special relativity, just wait long enough and you can have information coming from that. So the short point is that it seems to me that the belief that the number of internal state of the black hole is bounded by the area, it's a dogma based on two wrong intuitions. The idea that the horizon, not only the confusion between the two entropies, but also the idea that the horizon is necessarily a event horizon. That was my second comment. And I think you've done a great job. And I hope this get more absorbed by the community, because I think that's right. Instead of finding complicated and subtle solution, there's a simple solution.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't want to be so extreme, but yeah. I agree. And I think also exactly this confusion between the event horizon and the trapping horizon that are used, sometimes used interchangeably, like, but they're completely different. They're completely different. And if you have a trapping horizon, I mean, and how can you have information loss, right? If everything is going in, eventually going out, you should not have an information loss. But if you have an event horizon, it should not surprise you that you will lose some information.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yes.
So I guess I've talked a lot already, but so there are no other questions by anyone, looks like. So I just wanted to kind of, maybe since this is a very one-sided group, so I wanted to just take aside a little bit, defend like the devil's advocate here for the central dogma, so being the dogmatic person. So there is something here which, walks like a dog and talks like a dog and, barks like a dog. And so we call it area over 4G or Beckett-Hawking entropy. And basically the reason people have been calling it for the past 40 years or so an entropy is that it's about everything else that the entropy does. And entropy everywhere else counts the numbers of degrees of freedom of a Hilbert space that's accessible to the system. So of course, you could say that this is a completely different system. And of course, that's a valid opinion. But I think it is very compelling to think that area, in fact, does play the role of entropy in the sense of counting all the degrees of freedom that are accessible. As far as an external observer is concerned, now, if there's like a maybe universe inside that does crazy things, I don't know what to say about that. But if you're trying to describe a Hamiltonian system from outside, like any other Hamiltonian system, and then you have a quantity that everywhere else counts the number of the dimension of Hilbert space, and we find a quantity that behaves exactly the same way in this gravitational system, then it's kind of compelling to think that it's the same quantity. It may not, but that's the idea. And so I think that's just the extent of argument. One may or may not buy it. The other part I just wanted to highlight again, but I wanted to say that actually, so this good thing that you brought this up. Actually, let me just leave it at that. I just wanted to remind you that the idea about the echo is that if you want to take this seriously, then the echo is kind of an outcome, because whatever that falls in cannot come in, just go in. Part of it should come out, and that would be the echo. But I want to let you respond to this, Francesco. Go ahead.
I agree with you, but on the other hand, I mean, if you think of this very simple system, and if you're close to A, then everything what you said completely follow through, like everything. But what behaves like an entropy, and it's really counting the degrees of freedom of A, but you should not expect it to count also the degrees of freedom of B, and. This degree of freedom of the matter that's falling inside the black hole, these are the analogs of B, because they are really space-like separated from you. Like when you do a la wall the definition of the entropy, you don't go inside the black hole.
This is a good question, and you could ask the same thing about like a thermodynamic entropy. That, I mean, we're talking about entropy of the gas in this room, but does that count the entropy of the photons and neutrinos and dark matter and everything that's in this room? And I think there is a clear answer to that from the standard thermodynamics, that if you have the components in this room that are strongly interacting with each other, so you get you could kind of mix in the phasor space, then those are the things that you count. The things you don't count are things that are not as strongly interacting, like neutrinos that are coming in this room. I don't count them as part of entropy in this room because they're not as strongly interacting. And then the question with matter and gravity is that, do you think matter is something completely separate and non-interacting with gravity in the black hole, or do you think they are mixing in each other's phasor space? And that's the question. If you think they are strongly interacting, then there is really one entropy. There aren't entropy of matter, entropy of gravity. If you think you can cleanly separate gravity and matter and assume that they're approximately non-interacting, then you could separate those two entropies. So that, I think that's the physical answer to that, to this kind of this statement.
It's not only if they are interacting or not, is if you can probe them or not. Also in black hole physics, you also have the Noether theorem, right? So you really completely lose the whatever is in the inside, you completely lose it from the outside. You cannot probe it. So from this point of view, from an outside observer, there is no difference whether or not
I agree. There is just
the type of matter is inside. Just the total energy of this matter which counts. And so this is why you cannot probe from outside these degrees of freedom. Of course, your point of view is this other point of view is completely fine. It's completely possible, but you just follow the logic of what I said, and then you need to abandon something else, and you can decide which one of the two, right? One of the two, right? And democratic.
Okay, so I see that there is another question by Carlo, but before that, are there questions from other participants, in particular those who did not speak so far? Okay, this doesn't seem to be the case, then Carlo, go ahead.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to monopolize the discussion. There are other comments, but if there is time, it seems to me that this is a central discussion of the story. So I'm happy to tell you how I would I would answer. I agree. If it moves like a, if it quacks, if it is blah blah blah, it is. That's and in fact there is a sense in which it seems to me that the number of degrees of freedom of black hole is bounded by the area. The point is that in which sense there is, and if there's something I would disagree with the language that Francesco's using, is the distinction gravity matter. I'm not sure that the exact distinction that you that you want. In fact, he even at some point changed a little bit language. The way I think we could tentatively see this distinction is the degrees of freedom that are sort of around the horizon. I don't want to be precise about here, whether there's an extended horizon, whether there's a membrane, whether there's a rind itself, and the degrees of freedom inside. Now, of course, in the if you do the classical computer simulation of a black hole that people do for LIGO, you cut the inside, right? You forget the inside. They don't evolve the inside. They just evolve a little bit around the horizon. They track the horizon, and they can't track the horizon locally because it's a trapping horizon. It's a dynamic horizon. It's not an event horizon. You don't need to evolve to finish. So you know exactly where the horizon is by local information. And the inside doesn't affect the outside. So very simply, I mean, just forget subtleties. If I get entangled with the B box and move the B box very far away, then when I interact with the A box, I can have a, if I started from A and B together, I can be entangled with something, so I can have a non-pure state outside, even if then by interacting with the A box, I cannot access this degree of freedom anymore. So these degrees of freedom inside are a little bit like the neutrinos I'm not interacting with, just because they're causally disconnected, they're not affecting me. But I want Nash to bring back to the point about the event horizon, namely, of course, if I assume that there's an event horizon, then whatever goes inside is lost. Mm-hmm. Fine, but then I'm making a strong statement about what happened at the end of the evaporation of black hole. Okay, namely that at the end of the evaporation of black hole, I know for sure that whatever inside is not going to come out, because that's what an event horizon is. So to the extent in which, so the subtlety is what we mean by outside. It seems to me is what we mean by outside. If by outside we mean outside before, let's say in space-time, there's the end of the evaporation of black hole. Before, when I am sort of not in the future of that moment, then fine. Okay, but if outside, I mean also outside, but in the future of that moment, then I'm outside the hypothesis on which I'm working. So I cannot draw a conclusion about information loss. That seems to be the point.
So Carlo, I just wanted to drill in that point. I mean, I think event horizon from a quantum mechanical point of view doesn't make any sense. It's a, I mean, yeah. It's a semantical. Yeah. So I mean, I completely agree with that. That I mean, if you have a quantum system, it doesn't mean to talk about event horizons for it. It might be some sort of approximate semi-classical notion, but quantum mechanically that doesn't exist. And I completely agree that, I mean, you get all sorts of paradoxes if you assume there is one. I assume if I subscribe to quantum mechanics, then there is no event horizon. And I mean, I guess you are on the same page with that. Yeah. Okay, cool. Okay, good.
More questions? Okay, if not, let's thank again Francesco for his nice talk.
Yeah.